everybody. Welcome back to the Parkridge Presby podcast. I have a special guest on our podcast today to talk about something that we've all been thinking about in this last year with COVID, and that's our mental health. So we have one of our church members here to talk about mental health, and Deanna is going to introduce herself to you.
Hi, I'm Dr. Deanna Conklin-Dano. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I'm in private practice in Chicago.
All right. And what has your practice looked like? Have you always had your own private practice, or what kind of, where have you been in the mental health space?
So my specialty is children and adolescents. And right after grad school, I spent about 5 years working in school-based health, which is paid for like by a hospital system, but you show up to a high school every day. So for about 5 years, I worked in a high school. And then after I had my own kids, I went into private practice. And as I did that, I have increasingly moved away from working directly with kids because of the hours and my own kids. And I work mostly with older teens, young adults, and then adults. And then I do some couple stuff. And I also have a specialty in divorce. So I do some mediation, and I do, like, I help parents with like parenting plans when they're going through a divorce. So that is one of my specialties.
So we're going to be talking about mental health, and we're going to be talking about mental health in COVID. And when this all took over our life almost a year ago exactly, when it's in the Chicago area, a couple weeks from now, right, is when we got our shelter in place order, right, a couple weeks from now. And my first question is, what, as a practitioner, was the first thing on your mind beyond like your own survival in your own household when you had to shut down and go virtual with your clients? Like, what were you thinking? What was on your mind?
So I think just like everyone else who was trying to pivot from going into the office to then working from home, I was just in a frantic like mess to figure out, like, to pack up all my charts and get them home and locked up safely at home instead of in their office, like, you know, to communicate to my clients what was happening, you know, to let them know, like, I was looking for HIPAA compliant, like, that's, you know, HIPAA compliant ways to meet with clients, you know, because that's just not what we did. And it's not what we did, and I'm not a tech savvy person. And so there was that. And in the first couple weeks, it was actually just kind of weird, because like a number of my clients were like, oh, I'm fine, I'll just wait till we get back in the office, right? Because at that time, we really didn't know how long it would be, right? Like a couple weeks, maybe a month. And you know, so like some people just thought like, that's too weird to meet online. Let's just wait till you get back in the office. And then a handful of people were like, yep, tell me how to log in and see you. And so for the first couple of weeks, I'd say I only really saw a handful of patients for the whole week. It was kind of a weird time. And I was also just trying to figure out my kids' lives and our family's lives. And if you remember that time, like how you get groceries and like just all the things that everyone was adjusting to. And then pretty quickly, within a couple of weeks, people who had thought they wanted to wait were getting more and more stressed out. And they said, part of the thing was they were trying to find private places to do a call with me from. Because, you know, when they come into my office, it's like the safe and protected space. And if they have kids or a spouse or whatever, like nobody's in the room with them. It's just them and me. And so now they're trying to find a place in their house where they can have complete privacy. I mean, some people take their stuff to the car and do call, like a Zoom with me in the car, or like a doxy or whatever, closets, like any place where they could like find some privacy. So some of it was just logistical, like getting up to speed. And then some people realized pretty quickly that the isolation and the stress of all the changes were really big, and that this wasn't ending right away. And so then pretty quickly it went from very slow to just slammed.
Yeah, it's almost hard to remember how panicked we all were a year ago.
Yeah.
Like, you're right. Yeah, how do you get groceries?
It was one of the things that creates a lot of stress for people, because most of our lives are enough routine that we just go through them and we don't have to make decisions nonstop. And people were getting decision-making overload, decision-making fatigue, because they were making big decisions. Is it safe for me to do this and that? Is it safe for my kids to do this and that? And little decisions. Where do I sit? How do I set my kid up? You know, how do we buy food to go to the grocery store once every 2 weeks if we can? Like little things and big things all the time. Everything was a new decision. And that we're just not set up as human beings like that. That's exhausting for people.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think about how many times when like in my life I've been having to make a big decision and it's been all I've thought, it's been consuming, right? You know, things like I became a parent in 2020, things around parenting are all consuming, things around moving or, you know, like all of these things are all consuming. And then you imagine, but like, what if also how you got breakfast was all consuming? It's like all of that.
How do you open your mail? And remember, like there was the phase
wiping down the mail. Making your own disinfectant and
yeah. So people, the first couple weeks, people were also, most of the sessions were just kind of a panic about, this is really stressful, I don't know what to do, or like, now my kids are at home and I'm trying to figure out work. Like it was very kind of decision-making focused, right? They were just trying to process like that every single aspect of their life had changed.
Yeah. And then we figured out it's going to be a while.
Yeah.
And it's been a while. And then what did it look like?
Well, you know, it's some of it has been really interesting for people, right? Because it has, for everybody, it shines a spotlight on something. And so people are learning things about themselves and about their family, some good, some bad, right? And everything about why we're in this position is terrible. The pandemic, the loss of lives, the loss of livelihoods, like all of that has been devastating, right? Some people have learned some good things, right? Like some moms will say, I love that I don't have to drive my kids to 30 different things every day. We're so much more relaxed. You know, like that they find some things that are actually calming about it. Now, over time, that also then got monotonous, right? Like that was great for a few months and then people went stir crazy, right? I mean, it's kind of gone in waves, I would say. But then for people who had already struggled with something, that tended to get worse, right? So if you think about, if you're already lonely, this made you more isolated, right? If your marriage was already fractured, and then you're now in the midst of all this stress, marriages just blew up. It was really like, you know, and I think I said that one of my specialties is divorce. Starting in the summer, just nonstop calls for like discernment counseling, which is for couples on the brink of divorce, couples going through a divorce. I mean, it was usually that's just a smaller part of my practice. And I couldn't believe how many calls were coming in for it. And then clients that I used to see who were doing fine came back into therapy because like all these new stressors, right? They're homeschooling their kids. They're, you know, their jobs have changed, all those things. Yeah.
Yeah. This is kind of backing up to the beginning, but maybe a question I should have asked for anybody who maybe has never been to therapy, maybe has a stigma about therapy. Maybe thinks they know who goes to therapy. Like who, I'm assuming you see all kinds of people with all kinds of issues. So tell us kind of what could dissuade some of that, or just tell us, you know, what the benefit of therapy is, what the purpose is for somebody who might be like, maybe, but I don't know. I couldn't need therapy, you know?
I take more of the Woody Allen approach. Like everybody could benefit from some therapy sometimes, right? And you know, a lot of times people think about therapy when they're in crisis. They're really depressed. They're having a lot of anxiety. There's a huge life transition, like a divorce or a move or something like that, that has precipitated a crisis in their life. And so they come into therapy. But I also think it can be about quality of life, right? So like, maybe you are functioning fine. You are going through the motions, or you're doing work, and you're or doing school, or, you know, doing life, but something doesn't feel right. You feel like you've lost your joy, or you don't seem to have much purpose or energy, you know, and it's not that you're not functioning. It's not a crisis, but the quality of life could be different. And I think that that's really, I wish more people understood that therapy can be so helpful for that kind of stuff. People who come into therapy will say about their loved ones or their friends sometimes, like, if I had a broken arm, they would understand why I'm limited right now. Or, you know, if I had diabetes, they'd know why I needed medication right now. But that other people also judge people's use of getting help. Like, you look fine, what's the problem? Or suck it up, or some version of that. And I really hope that as a world, we can come to a different place on that, because I think it's a huge sign of strength to go in to get help, right? Like, if you don't understand something in school, you go to the teacher and ask for help. If you don't understand something in your faith life, you might go to your minister, right? Like, if something isn't working in your emotional life or your relational life, that's what we're there for.
Yeah. I've been preaching this book to everyone. It's like a kind of a kid's book, kind of an adult book. The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse. I've been like preaching this book to everybody, and there are these illustrations with like little quotes. And one of the illustrations was, you know, when have you been your strongest? It's like these characters asking questions to each other. When have you been your strongest? And the answer was when I showed my weakness. And you know, what's the bravest thing you've ever said? And the answer was help. And this book came out at the beginning of 2020, and it's kind of blown up on Instagram, and you know, it's getting, I don't know, people are, I was given it and I'm telling everybody about it. But I love that. I love those images and those phrases for right now. What's the bravest thing somebody could maybe do right now is say help, even if, you know, people would have assumed their life on the outside was perfect, and you know, they couldn't need help. Look, they've got it all together, you know?
Well, if we know anything from, you know, Facebook and Instagram, it's that people can show one side to the world, and like, it can look really different behind the scenes, right? And so it's exhausting to wear a mask and pretend like everything's okay all the time.
Do you think one of, you know, we touched on some of the good or more helpful realizations people might be having because of the impact of the pandemic. Do you think asking for help and one's mental health and caring for the self, you know, do you think 5 years from now we might be having different conversations because people learned some things in the last year?
I hope so, right? I mean, I hope that the people who reached out for help the first time found it during the pandemic, because it got unbearable, realized that it was helpful, and they share that with people, right? I mean, I think one of the things that's finally changing in our world is celebrities or sports people coming out and saying, like, I have an anxiety disorder, or I suffer from depression. And so we're finally starting to see in, I mean, real people, I'm putting that in quotes, right? But people that people identify with or think that their lives are perfect or whatever, admitting that these are struggles that everybody has, right? And so I'm hoping that like all kinds of things change the stigma. Part of the thing that is can be an issue is, you know, some people will come into my office and they would never tell anybody that they're in therapy. So even if like somebody was struggling in their lives, it's not like they would necessarily say, oh, I go to therapy, you should do it too, right? Like, we still have some barriers to overcome. But I do think younger generations are more open to it. I think it is changing. And I also, my experience, the longer I'm in private practices, once people come into therapy and realize it can be helpful, they come back to it again if something comes up later.
Mm-hmm. So our communities might have more and more people who've reached out for help, who felt, you know, that they had resources to rely on when they were in crisis, And hopefully one day they'll start telling people those things too, you know, in our smaller real communities.
Yeah, being vulnerable and saying like, this helped me and it could help you, right? Mm-hmm. I think anything that helps people realize that there's lots of places to get help and that it's okay and it's not, you know, it doesn't mean anything about you. It means that you're strong enough to ask for help.
Yeah. Did you find that some of the conversations like you were having with clients or some of the things that they were finding helpful were the same pre-pandemic and during COVID, or do we need different things now? Or, is what is helping people now always been true, or are we discovering some new things?
Well, I think I don't know if this will answer it, so tell me if it doesn't. I think part of the problem was some of the things that always have helped people, or we always tell them to do, were no longer available, right? Like when someone is in a crisis, we are trying to get all their internal and external resources lined up, right? And so internal resources being kind of like how they cope, and the external resources being, you know, friends or family or supports outside of themselves. And all of a sudden we're in a situation where like if you were sad, I might say to you like, well, who's a friend you might get together with once a week and have coffee with, right? Or take a walk with, or for people who use exercise because it really does help people with their moods, right? They lost their gyms and their, you know, and it's great in the summer, but in the winter in Chicago, it gets much trickier, right? And so like a lot of the things that we help people access in their lives stopped being available in the same ways, right? And so it goes back to like they had to reinvent the wheel. How do I have a social life so that I don't feel isolated, right? Like we're all trying to figure out Zoom calls and drive-by parties. And like, so some of it was, I think, having to get really creative about how to find the things that used to be so readily available.
I think that's exactly what I was thinking of was, you know, like what if some of the things that I think maybe would have seemed simple before, grab some Starbucks, you know, like would have, those things weren't simple anymore. They weren't available. And getting creative sounds hard to me. Like that sounds like extra work. Like that doesn't.
Well, and it's especially hard when you're stressed out, right? You tend to get a little more rigid when you're overstressed, and being flexible is actually the most adaptive thing you can be, and it's the hardest thing to be when you are not doing well. Do you know what I mean? And so pivoting and finding new ways to connect with people, you know, because part of it was also about adapting to what's safe, right? Like some people would, you know, across our country or the world would say like, screw that, I'm just gonna do everything like I've always done. Right. And like, and then that's not adaptive to the reality, like the new facts that we're dealing with. And so it really requires a lot, I think, of flexibility to kind of say, oh my gosh, this is my new reality. And I don't know how long it will last. And I have to adjust to this for a while. Right. I'm a social person. I love to get together with my friends and go out with my family and do stuff. And so that was a loss for me. I also think like talking about loss became like a really important thing to validate for people because I certainly had clients and people I knew who lost jobs, who were furloughed, whose economic situation changed. But I also knew a lot of people who were lucky enough to pivot and have jobs and have, you know, some security. And so then they felt like they couldn't complain about the things that they'd lost, right? Like, well, at least I'm working, or, you know, at least I'm healthy or whatever. And I don't minimize those things at all. Health and work are great. But like, when we get into the world of like the misery Olympics and who's winning, who's got the worst situation, it's so invalidating for people, right? Like a loss is a loss. So obviously a loss of life is different and the loss of your income is different, but it is a loss to have had some special trip planned and not go on it, right? to have your prom canceled, right? To have, to celebrate a milestone event in your life, like if you're supposed to have your wedding or a big birthday or the birth of a child, right? Like all these things were losses. And I think one of the things I have worked really hard to do within my own practice and in my family with my kids particularly is to validate those losses, to not dismiss them, to not rush to like, at least we're all healthy, or, you know, at least we all have food on the table. You can get to those pieces later, but like, you really do have to acknowledge that these are losses for people.
Right. And they can't really move through the loss without feeling it. Like somebody's going to have to be in a bad mood one day. And that needs, you know, that's what they need that day, is to be cranky, you know?
Yeah.
The first real loss I had when, you know, when we were all starting to make different decisions a few months out based on COVID was my baby shower got canceled. And I went from having 3 baby showers to 0. And I was pouting around this house like a baby, but it mattered to me and it was sad. Yeah. I do remember feeling bad that I was feeling bad. And I wonder how many people are out there feeling like, you know, they lost something, but then they felt like they couldn't talk about it because
it wasn't. You're not allowed to say I lost my baby shower when someone else is worried about their health or their income.
Right.
And I actually think that that's not a helpful way to approach things, because when we can have empathy for ourselves, we can have empathy for other people, I think, right? You know what I mean? Or compassion for ourselves and compassion for other people. So it's not a matter of rank ordering people's sadnesses and losses, right? It's like, it's valid at the time. It's a loss. You know, my husband turned 50 the weekend that we went into stay at home. And so we had planned a huge party. We had all this food catered, but the party got canceled. I mean, we ate meatballs and bruschetta for 2 weeks, right? And like that was his 50th birthday. And that, you know, like, again, not the end of the world, but it was sad.
Yeah. I think it was Brené Brown's podcast where she said, you know, the worst loss is always yours. Meaning like, it's yours and you get to feel that. And it, you know, whether it's a prom or graduation or whatever, because I think early on, you know, parents were paying attention to what their kids were losing, but then also wanting to get, you know, create some perspective. Yes, jinx perspective around it.
I knew that was the word you were going to say, or I was pretty sure, because parents will always say like, oh my God, my kid, you know, they have no perspective on this, or they just don't know how good they have it, or whatever they've said pre-pandemic, right? Like, this is not exclusive to the pandemic. And I like to remind people that the only way we get perspective is through life experience. And kids have not had life experience. Teens have not had life experience. They don't have perspective. Someday they will have perspective from life experience. And telling them that like it's just your prom is not helpful. That's something many people dream about, right? Or whatever it is. I mean, athletes lost seasons of their favorite sport, right? And for some kids, that was the thing that brought them joy, or friendship, or possibly a college scholarship, right? Like, these are real things. And when we dismiss them, it doesn't help anyone move through it, right? We just have to sit with the loss with our kids and say like, yeah, that's really tough. And, you know, I'm sorry. And sometimes I think there were ways, it's been really lovely to see how people have tried to offer alternatives to ease the blow, right? Like an acquaintance of mine, her daughter lost her prom. And so the dad, you know, put on a tux and danced with his daughter and like, they did the whole thing, right? She still wore the dress because she'd already bought it. Like, And so it's not prom, but she will have a lovely memory of her dad, well, her parents stepping up and really, you know, so stuff like that. I think the way people learned how to celebrate a birthday has been remarkable in COVID.
Right. The summer of drive-by honking parades. I thought I went to a ton of them for our church kids. I went to all the graduation parades near the church. But they did run their course of cuteness. They did get old of the honking and the honking. So much honking.
I think if nothing else, when we get out of this, people will absolutely value their relationships and celebrating with people, getting together with people, mourning with people, right? Like the Zoom funerals and memorials or postponed or no.
Not at all. Yeah. Yeah. Postponed grief is gonna come back and kick some of us in the next few months.
I think we can't possibly know how this will affect us over time, right? Like developmentally, kids are having weird experiences. A friend of mine's grandson was maybe 6 months old when COVID hit. He only knows four adults. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's weird. That's different. And they're good for great adults, luckily. But like, this is not, you know, we don't know what this will mean for people, right? Adolescents who are only supposed to be with their friends and not their families in this way are only with their families, and they're going crazy with their families.
You said something to me once. You were talking to me and Terry and saying that teenagers aren't supposed to spend this much time with their parents.
Yeah.
And it, you know, we were just kind of chatting about life, but I thought about that so much in terms of developmentally what social groups are doing for adolescents. You know, this is, it's identity forming. It's an important part of development for adolescents, this phase for developing into healthy functioning adults, and they're having to do it in very, some ways restricted ways, some ways limited ways. The world feels very small to teenagers right now, I feel like. And so, yeah, what's that going to do? And how are these kids going to go to college then one day? I have so many questions.
Well, and we don't know what some of this will look like, right? Does it just delay some of it so that, you know, it just kind of, instead of at 14, they're forming these peer groups, it's more like 15 or 16, because that was where they were at that age, right? Like, I mean, I think it looks different for different kids and different ages, and then, and different families have solved it in different ways, right? Like, you know, I have teenagers, and lots of the moms would talk about, like, what are the risks I'm willing to take to get mental health for my kids, you know, at the potential cost of some physical health, right? And trying to find the safest way to let your kids socialize, because it just didn't feel like an option to not socialize at all. And so, like, luckily in the summer, what that meant was kids sitting outside, distanced, you know, eating and talking, you know, they brought their own foods or their own water bottles. Like, it was so different than what it might have used to look like. It got a lot more complicated when the weather got worse, right? But those relationships matter to kids.
It's their whole, when something happens in a teenager's friend group, in a girl teenager's friend group, it's consuming. That's their lives, you know? And so this disruption, I really do have some concerns about how it plays out. You know, I do know that kids are kinder in person than they are online, and we're living so much of our lives online, so I have concerns about that.
And yet, like, and that is a dilemma for parents, right? Like, all this screen time. Like, screen time used to be something we parsed out, you know, responsibly, or like, you know, and now it's like, they spend their whole day in school online, and then their homework, half of it's done online, right? On a computer, on a screen. Their socialization is done this way. They're texting, they're, you know, FaceTiming or they're whatever, right? And so you can't say you got to turn off your phone, because that's actually when you get to see your friend. So then there's this weird thing of like 12, 14 hours a day on a screen, right? Like kids who used to maybe spend, I don't know, a few hours, right? Like that's a lot. We don't know what that's doing to people.
Right. What are some, so there's, if you had to say some of the big questions that you have of the, we don't know what this is going to do, is the this, so we've got screen time and the bizarre impact to our socialization. What are some of the other this concerns that you think of when you just let yourself wonder about what are we going to be dealing with on the other side of this?
Well, so I think about, I mean, I definitely think about anxiety, right? And anxious, I mean, anxious anybody, but if we're talking about anxious kids or teens, right? Some of them find being at home easier, right? And so then it's like, how do we bridge them back to the world again after cocooning them in this kind of comfort zone that isn't developmentally helpful to them, right? Like some of the kids are just itching to get back out there. Some kids, you know, more with boys, I hear the moms say, you know, they're a little too comfortable in the basement on the video game. And then with some anxious girls, and you know, certainly this can go across genders, but like that has anecdotally been more the experience. And some anxious girls who are already very worried about going back, right? Like they already are self-conscious about their friendships and they have some social anxiety. And now they haven't seen these kids in a year. Like, will they have friends? Do they have to start over? Like this is something that the anxious kids are thinking about. And anxiety is up during this experience. So even previously not anxious kids are anxious. You know, anxiety and depression are both way up, kids and adults. And then they're also, I think, starting to see some regressive behavior in younger kids, right? Things that they've mastered, they're slipping back on. Like, and that's a sign of, you know, of stress for kids.
That's so much. It's so much. And so much that I know our young people and kids aren't the only ones bearing it, but I guess I'm just particularly sensitive to it. I love, you know, what I get to do with kids and teenagers, and it feels so, it's also unfair, but it feels particularly burdensome, I think, to think about the impact on our younger people.
Yeah, I have these moments where I can go just back and forth between awe at like the resilience and the strength as they like move through this challenge, and then just heartbreaking, like this just isn't what it's supposed to be like for them, right? My daughter is on the dance team and they finally got to dance. But what it looked like was like the boys played basketball in the gym and the girls were elsewhere in the building, distanced and masked. The boys play basketball to an empty gym. The boys leave the gym. The girls go in and dance to an empty gym. And then the boys go back. And it's live stream so the parents can watch or their friends can watch or whatever. But like, I was just saying, like, this is going to be so much more fun because when this is normal, because then you can go with your friends and go out for pizza afterwards or whatever, you know, like you'll interact with people. And yet, like, even that just feels like such a great thing to have some reasonably safe outlet.
Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of questions about what this will continue to, you know, challenge us with or strengthen us with or create resilience for us. What are some of the things that are, what's helping people right now? What are some of the things we would want to share with people who maybe haven't ever ventured into therapy themselves, might not know where they fit in this conversation, but we can all be helped by helpful things. What are some of the things that are helping anxious kids right now?
So I think it looks different for different people, but like certainly creating some consistency and predictability, right? Some routines, trying to help people understand that like this is time limited. It won't be forever, right? Because back to the perspective thing, kids and teens, I mean, are feeling like this is never going to end. And so reminding them that, yes, this is hard and it will end, right? Like we don't know how and when exactly, right? And it's not going to be a flip that switches and everything goes back to normal. Some things may never look the same. You know, we don't know. But it will look more similar than different at some point. And that these things will come back. So reminding people of perspective, right? I think whatever people do that is healthy and constructive to deal with feelings, right? So different people have different ways of doing that. And so I think we know some unhealthy ways, you know, when people eat or drink their feelings or, you know, bottle them up or those kinds of things. But when people can find people to talk to, friends or family members or professional, right? Engaging in things that you like still, right? Finding ways to do them, if it's exercise, if it's reading, if it's catching up with friends, like finding ways to continue to do that, you know, and also knowing your own slippery slope, right? For some people, like it might be binge watching TV and then they just start to feel depressed, right? Like it seems like such a good idea, but like it turns out 6 hours into laying on the couch in your pajamas doesn't actually make you feel better usually, right? Or wine with adults or whatever, you know, substances that people like, things like knowing like when you are headed down a path that is not helpful to you and finding ways to go a different way. And I think that usually involves some vulnerability in talking about it with someone. And it doesn't have to be a professional. It can be your partner. It can be your parent. It can be your best friend. I think that that can be helpful. I guess it's like self-care, right? When we think about self-care, we think about physical self-care, getting enough sleep and eating healthy and exercising enough, right? And we think about emotional self-care, doing things that help us feel good, and like our social relationships. And so finding ways to keep self-care in place, again, even if it looks different.
Yeah, even if you have to get creative or, you know, learn something new, do something you haven't done before. Because I think because this has been so much longer than anyone would have wanted or thought, there is no hustle through this. There is no just hit the grind and you're gonna get through this without stopping to think about your physical health and your mental health and your social health and your emotional health. And, you know, I'm surrounded by a lot of people that would acknowledge that you have to stop and check in on those things. But I also just believe there's got to be this population out there that's like, what are you talking about? I don't need to slow down and talk about things.
Well, I think, you know, what's interesting is actually some people, when they slow down, they're more upset because that's when the feelings come up, right? Like they're so busy to keep that at bay. And this has forced most people to slow down in some ways, right? And that is very unsettling to some people.
There's got to be so many people, you know, whether they hustle through that first part of the slowdown and then now maybe they're hitting it, or you mentioned too, it comes in waves. And I think, you know, some of these practices of making sure you've got checkpoints and making sure you have people who are going to check in on all these different aspects of how is it going and how's it going really throughout this is really important for all of us.
Well, and I think I've heard from so many people what a roller coaster it is. Some days you're like, this is great. I'm baking my bread and I'm, you know, scrapbooking or whatever the thing is that you never had time to do before. And then 2 days later, you're sobbing because all you want is to be around your friends or you know, on a trip or, you know, doing something that you love, right? And that it is a roller coaster. It's not a straight and easy shot. And I think there was a lot of people who in the first few weeks were just fueled by figuring things out, right? And so they were really focused. And then they just had this kind of like willpower. But willpower doesn't last, right? Like then the longer it went, it just was like, okay, now I'm gonna have to do something different because I can't just power through this. And I think moms have really struggled in all this, right? Because they're trying to keep their kids afloat emotionally and academically. Many of them are working and trying to juggle this stuff. And I hear anecdotally from a lot of women, like, everybody's allowed to fall apart in the house except for me. You know, if the kids stomp around, you give them some grace because it's a rough time. Yep, they're in a mood. Shake it off or whatever, right? But if mom does that, then the whole household freaks out. And so I have heard from women that the longer this goes, like, it is just unsustainable.
I remember being a kid, and if my mom ever got a cold or, God forbid, the flu, it was game over. One time, legitimately, my dad dropped me off at the wrong elementary school. My mom was sick. And my dad was not the parent that dropped us off at school. We had just moved to the area. I didn't know it wasn't my school. It was terrible. It haunts us all. Each and every one of us in the family is haunted by that moment. And that was just mom being sick, yeah. You know, for like a day. I don't even know. But I do think there is that lack of permission for moms to have a moment.
Yeah, to have their bad day.
Yeah. What do we do about that? Anything? Is there anything to do about that?
So my philosophy is, I think friends and professionals can be really helpful in this realm too, right? families, friends, and like our relationships, right? Like when you find out that all the other moms are going through the same thing, and there are dads going through this too, like I don't want to stereotype, it's everybody, right? But like, since we're talking about moms, like you find your mom friends and you talk about it honestly. Like, is anyone else falling apart? Because if I do one more, like the dishwasher runs nonstop. People eat nonstop, it turns out, when they don't leave your house ever. You know what I mean? Like, and not everyone wants to put their dishes in the dishwasher. So
no. Yeah.
So I think finding people who can either validate your experience or help you find the humor in it can be really helpful. I find humor to be an incredibly helpful coping mechanism. And I will say the memes that have come out of this 2020, 2021 era have been the highlight of it, really, right?
Right. The internet is doing some good things for
it's not all bad.
Not all bad. Yeah.
But knowing that you're not alone is really helpful to people. And so finding people who can understand what you're going through is really valuable. And taking time for yourself, right? Like we always use the oxygen mask example, like on the airplane, right? Like you do have to take care of yourself because you can't take care of other people if you're not taking care of yourself.
Is there anything that you would want to end with other than those invitations and helpful tips you've shared?
I think it's kind of where we started, which is to reach out for help if you need it. And that can be from anybody that you would find helpful, right? Someone who's non-judgmental. And it can be a professional, or it can be a family member or a neighbor or a friend. But like, this is a very isolating time, and we are not creatures who operate that way. We are social beings and we need help and community. And so finding your support system and really, really using it. Not trying to be a hero or a martyr, but really using your support system.
Thank you so much for your time tonight and for sharing with us. And I think the more that we can talk about the fact that there are resources for people and just that friends and family can be resources, I think is a really helpful reminder for people. That reminder that we're not alone is one that we need to hear often to continue to believe it.
Thanks again for listening today. If you'd like to hear more from us, you can subscribe to this podcast or find us on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube. We are at Park Ridge Presby on all platforms.